Golf Club of California. In the absence of Mr. Burt Levitt, I have the honor to serve as quarterly chairman. My name is Ray Marks. Our speaker next week will be His Excellency, Sir Harold Katcha, Ambassador of Great Britain. His topic will be trade and aid. Our speaker today is a member of a fine American family, which a recent issue of Look magazine described as the remarkable Kennedys. After graduating from Harvard in 1948, Bob Kennedy visited Israel and Jordan during the British withdrawal, Greece during the Civil War, and Czechoslovakia at the time of Jan Masaryk's death. In late 1948, he entered the University of Virginia Law School, from which he graduated in 1951. Our speaker then went to work in Washington for the Department of Justice, and in 1951 spark-plugged the campaign which elevated his brother from congressman to senator. He then turned to investigatory work for various Senate committees and was named Outstanding Investigator of 1957. After the 1954 election, he became chief counsel of the McClellan Committee. In 1955, he launched an investigation of Army procurement, which led to Johnny Dio of New York, a friend of Jimmy Hoffa. Further investigations convinced him that racketeers had infiltrated the Teamsters in New York, as well as in Minneapolis, Detroit, and Portland. In 1956, our speaker began investigations of the Teamsters Union in Portland, which led to David Beck, General President of the Teamsters International Union, and eventually to the latter's prosecution. During the first 12 months of the committee's work, it held 104 days of public hearings and heard testimony of 486 witnesses. 16,000 persons were interviewed by Mr. Kennedy and by his staff of 34 assistants. The topic of his talk today is racketeering in labor-management relations. It is my privilege, gentlemen, indeed, to present Robert F. Bob Kennedy, Chief Counsel of the McClellan Committee.
Chairman, distinguished guests at the head table, and my friends in San Francisco. I am very happy and honored to be here today. As I was coming into your club and into the hotel, I received a telegram from evidently from a fan who said, addressed to Robert Kennedy, the Commonwealth Club, Palace Hotel, "Dear Bob, just no members of the Commonwealth Club will love you in San Francisco. Why don't you stay there? Love, signed Jimmy." They were very kind words that were said about me, and I might say they're a kind of words that have been said about me by some people over the period of the past 2.5 years. I received a letter from a young lady when they were televising some of the hearings live, and she wrote and said that she followed the hearings very carefully, and she really appreciated all the work that we were doing, and she was thought that I was doing extremely well, and then that went on for the first 7 paragraphs. Then in the 8th paragraph, she said, "The only trouble, Mr. Kennedy, is that I'm not able to understand any of your questions." But she said, "That doesn't really make me feel too bad, because looking at the members of the committee and the witnesses, they don't seem to be able to understand them either." I'm not really sure that I belong here today. I had some exchange and correspondence with the officers of the club, and they asked me to come, and we finally arranged a mutually convenient date. And then finally, the last letter came to me saying how pleased they were to have me, but the only trouble is that it was addressed to Senator Kennedy. I've had those problems, however, before. I was having breakfast in Detroit one day, and this gentleman came up to me and said, "You're really doing a terrific job. We're all very proud of you, and you're making a major contribution to the country." And I bowed my head modestly. And then he put out his hand. He said, "I want to shake your hand. This is the first time I've shaken the hand of a United States senator." But he said, "Senator Kennedy, there's one thing that puzzles me." He said, "You know that fellow that sits next to you, the counsel of the committee, do you know he looks exactly like you?" But I got even on one occasion. He was coming down from Boston to Washington on a nonstop plane, and I had been in Boston at the same time and received a degree from a university. And so he was sitting, got into the plane, and he sat down, and the lady next to him said, "Senator, I was out at Tufts, and it's really wonderful. I saw you get that degree." And he said, oh, no, that's my brother. So they took off, and they were flying for a while. And then she turned to him and said, oh, you're the one with all the children. And he said, no, that's my brother. So then they arrived in Washington, and then she turned to him and said, well, you tell your brother, give him my best wishes. I certainly hope he's elected president of the United States. And he said, no, that's me. Our committee has been in existence now some 2.5 years, and during that period of time, we heard some 1,500 witnesses in some 500 sessions of the committee. In addition to that, we received some 150,000 letters of complaint. We feel that the committee was supported by members of organized labor throughout the country, not only because of the action that the AFL-CIO took against the Teamsters Union and other unions, but by the fact that over 75% of the letters of complaint that we received came from members of organized labor. It was an analysis of the hearings that we held and the complaints that we received that were the basis for the law that was passed in the House of Representatives, the Senate, and signed by the President of the United States. The Dave Becks of a year ago or the Jimmy Hoffas of today would be forgotten. However, the defects in law that permitted their operations would return to plague us with new Becks and Hoffas unless we were able to come up with some basic solutions, some answers to the problems that obviously existed. That was what our task was. And I think with the passage of the bill, it is a major step forward. It is not a perfect piece of legislation. There are parts of it that, in my estimation, are extremely unfair to certain honest unions and will make industrial unionization in the South very, very difficult. But it is a major step forward, and it was an absolutely essential step. And I think I thought today that I would talk with you about a few of the things that we uncovered which made some of the provisions of the law absolutely essential. One of the first things that we went into was in the field of pension and welfare funds. It actually was the Ives and Douglas Committee several years ago, which brought to the attention of the American public and to Congress the dramatic situations which showed the need of some kind of federal control over pension and welfare funds. They developed the fact that Jimmy James, an official of the Laundry Workers Union, and several of his colleagues had taken over $900,000 of the pension and welfare funds of a relatively small union. And because it was not a crime to take money, a federal crime, to take money from a pension and welfare fund, there was nothing that the federal government could do. And because of jurisdictional problems, at least up until the present time, there's nothing that the states have been able to do. Jimmy James was indicted on income tax evasion, and his attorneys who were paid out of union funds came in and argued that poor old Jimmy James shouldn't have to pay taxes on this money because he embezzled it, and embezzled funds do not constitute income. We went into a situation in connection with the Central Conference of Teamsters where the award was made in 1949 and 1950. It was made to a company that was represented by a man by the name of Alan Dorfman. At that time, the trustees were told that there would be no commissions paid on the insurance. Alan Dorfman's company was not the low bidder. The low bidder was turned down by Mr. Hoffa on the grounds that they were not financially able, the Pacific Mutual Company. They were not, although they had 50 times greater assets at that time than the company to whom the award was given. We have found in expert testimony before our committee that Alan Dorfman was paid excess of commissions over and above the regular commissions of $1,600,000 over the period of the past 8 years. And you might ask why that happened. It happened because Mr. Hoffa, who was then beginning his spread outside of Michigan, needed the help and assistance of the Teamsters in the Chicago area. Mr. Alan Dorfman's father is Mr. Paul Dorfman, who's an important figure in the Chicago underworld, and he needed his help and assistance. And this deal was made at that time, and it's cost the union members over $1,600,000 in these excess of commissions. There was some legislation that was passed 2 years ago to control pension and welfare funds, but it's completely inadequate legislation. And there is a definite need for some more laws in this field, in this area, to guard the hundreds of millions of dollars that are tied up in pension and welfare funds. An area which was covered by the bill was in the field of misuse and misappropriation of union funds. One of the first areas that we went into when we developed the fact that Mr. Dave Beck had taken, not borrowed, some $370,000 from the Western Conference of Teamsters alone. But we found other union officials who regard unions as their own personal possessions to do with what they will. This is my union, they say. They can spend the money as they see fit. For instance, Mr. Hoffa had four Michigan Teamster officials, who were friends of his, who were convicted of extortion, who were sent to the penitentiary. He continued their salaries after they went to jail, after they were convicted of betraying the union membership, so that at the time we held our hearings in 1958, these four men had received over $140,000 of union funds for which they had done no work. He had another friend, Mr. Gerald Conley, down in Miami. He was involved in an attempted murder, a laundry owner who wouldn't sign a contract. He fled Florida. He went up to Minneapolis, Minnesota. He was made a Teamster Union official eventually. In 1955, he was involved in an extortion. He was indicted and convicted. Late 1955, he was involved in another extortion, indicted and convicted. In early 1956, he placed picket lines in front of some cell phone businessmen. His fellow Teamster officials refused to recognize the picket line, so he placed dynamite in their homes and in their automobiles. He was indicted and convicted for that. He was a friend of Mr. Hoffa. Mr. Hoffa took $63,000 of union funds defending Mr. Gerald Conley. He had another friend, Mr. Lou Bearer in St. Louis, Missouri. Mr. Bearer was building his own home at the same time he was building the union headquarters. As the bills came into his own home, he forwarded them to the union headquarters, okayed them, and paid them out of union funds. He was indicted and convicted for income tax evasion. Mr. Hoffa spent $35,000. He and his chief lieutenant, Harold Gibbons, spent $35,000 defending Mr. Lou Bearer, including taking $5,000 to take an appeal to the Supreme Court to argue once again for Mr. Bearer that he shouldn't have to pay taxes on this money because he embezzled it. Mr. Hoffa took $500,000 out of a Detroit bank where it was paying interest and transferred it to a Florida bank to induce the Florida bank to loan money on a land scheme in which he had a personal financial interest. And there it paid no interest. In the meantime, he placed the promoter of the land scheme on the payroll of the Teamsters, and he received $90,000 in salary and expenses. At the time he was placed on the payroll, he was a fugitive from a rogue gang here in California. And since our investigation has been picked up in two separate states for the unlawful possession of narcotics. He loaned $150,000 to a friend of his who then turned and loaned him $25,000. $50,000 went to a racetrack where his fellow Teamster official and financial partner had a string of horses. $40,000 went to another friend of his who was unable to get a loan from a bank because he had been arrested 22 times. $12,000 went to another friend who was unable to get a loan from a bank because he had been arrested 18 times and convicted on 7 occasions. He used $5,000 of union funds to hide his brother from the police when he was wanted for armed robbery. Several thousands of dollars of union funds were used to find his brother's runaway wife. He loaned $200,000 of union funds to the John W. Thomas department store, which at the time was on strike by a fellow AFL union. After that, the general manager of the department store, who was a friend of Mr. Hoffa, purchased the department store by putting up a $15,000 note. Mr. Hoffa then loaned the department store $1 million. 3 months later, the department store went into bankruptcy, and Mr. Hoffa's friend took off with $130,000. So it's on and on and on to millions of dollars for Mr. Hoffa and his cronies alone. And that it was not just the only problem, the misuse or misappropriation of union funds. We were making an investigation up in New York City of a Teamsters union. We found that the Teamster union officials were making out checks to fictitious people. They would then endorse the names on the back, cash them, and keep the money. So we went to the Department of Labor to find out how these sums of money were reported in the reports that unions who want access to the National Labor Relations Board must file every year. We first found that the reports were in only rare instances ever examined. So we had the Secretary of Labor appear before our committee and the Chairman of the National Labor Relations Board, and we asked them why they didn't examine these reports that were filed every year and had to be filed under the Taft-Hartley Act. And they told us that they didn't examine them because under their interpretation of a Supreme Court decision, that these reports did not have to be true or accurate, that all that was necessary under the law was that the reports be filed every year and it didn't matter what was on them. So there was a feeling, and a strong feeling, in Congress that there should be some control over union funds, over the misappropriation or misuse of union funds, that union funds should not be used in the manner that I have described, and that reports should be filed every year and that the reports should be true and accurate. And this is encompassed in the bill that passed Congress and was signed by the President of the United States. Another area which we spent a considerable amount of time was in the lack of democratic procedures and processes within unions. Because we have found that there is a direct relationship between a lack of democracy within unions, some unions, and corruption. First, we went into the 1956 Joint Council election of the Teamsters in New York City, where Mr. Hoffa, together with Johnny DioGuardia, the three-time convicted labor extortionist, were attempting to gain control of the 140,000 Teamsters in that area. And under the in a Joint Council election, every local union has 7 votes, no matter what its membership. It might have 10,000 members or 100 members. It still has 7 votes in a Joint Council election. They chartered local unions that had no membership whatsoever in order to influence this election. They selected friends as the chief officers of these locals who were friends of Johnny DioGuardia. While he was in the labor movement, he brought 40 people into the labor organizations under him, who between them had 178 arrests and 77 convictions. These were the nucleus of these new Teamster locals. But there were other individuals who were made lesser officers and delegates who did not even know they were in a labor organization, let alone officers of a Teamsters union. We had one man appear before our committee. We showed him his credentials and that he had voted in the election. And he said that he didn't know he was in a labor organization. We asked him if he remembered voting. He said, well, he was in Joe Sword's bar in Lower New York one day having a drink. And he said, somebody came in and said, let's all go down to the amphitheater and vote. So we asked him if he had gone down to the amphitheater and voted, and he said, unfortunately, he couldn't answer that question as he was too drunk that day. Another man said he couldn't possibly have voted in the election because at the time of the election, he was on a traveling crap game around the United States. At least 75% of the delegates who participated in the election in Miami, Florida, in September and October of 1957, were elected illegally. And you might ask how that happened. It happened by Mr. Dave Beck waiving the Constitution for his then-candidate, Mr. James Hoffa, so Mr. Hoffa could be elected president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. We found individuals who claimed that they were properly elected in July and August of 1957 who had their credentials issued to them in April and May of 1957. We had one such individual appear before our committee. We asked him if he was a delegate, and he said that he was. We asked him when he was elected, and he said, tonight. We had a group in New York City who were not elected as delegates until 13 days after the convention was over. There is a provision in the Teamsters Constitution that if you do not have your dues paid up on the first day of the month, you cannot run for office. Well, where a company checkoff system is used, the dues do not arrive at the union headquarters until the second, third, or fourth day of the month. So what has been used in the Central Conference of Teamsters and in the East is that the only people that are allowed to run for office are the incumbent officers who pay their own dues, because they're the only ones that get their dues in on time. Everybody else is declared ineligible. So year after year, in many of the locals of the Central Conference of Teamsters, these officers are returned to office to positions of power without any opposition. And unfortunately, gentlemen, this is not a situation that's restricted merely to the Teamsters Union. We went into the operating engineers. Out of the 270,000 members of the operating engineers, less than 50% of them can vote for any international officers or for any local officers. They just do not have the right to vote. They must pay full dues and full initiation fees, but they cannot vote. And the problem goes beyond that. For instance, Local 3 here in San Francisco, they were voting for the international officers. 2,000 votes were cast. They picked up the ballots and they went to a small cabin outside the city. And they had a few drinks, the election committee, and they started to count the votes. And they got to about 500 and they said, well, they didn't think it was probably necessary to count anymore because they could see what the trend was. So they handed the votes over to ballots over to Mr. Swanson to make the announcement for the following week as to who had won the election. And he announced that his friends of his received some 18,000 votes and his enemies received some 230 votes. So when Mr. Swanson appeared before the committee, we asked him how it was possible that when only 2,000 votes were cast, only 500 were counted, how somebody could receive 18,000 votes. Well, he said he padded the voting a bit. He said that he added on. But he said he didn't see why he should not. He said everybody else in the international does the same thing. So there was a feeling in Congress that there should be some kind of control over democratic procedures and guarantees to the union membership, guarantees to the honest union official and to the general public. Another area which has concerned us tremendously has been the infiltration of organized crime and criminals into certain labor unions. This is a situation that you do not have here in the West Coast. In my estimation, the Teamsters, the Western Conference of Teamsters, is the cleanest organization of the Teamsters of any place in the country without any question. With the exception of three individuals who are chief lieutenants of Mr. Hoffa down in Los Angeles, California, we found no major corruption. And in my estimation, that is a reflection on the industry as well as on the union officials, because we have found that there is always a close relationship between corruption as far as union officials and corruption as far as management is concerned. But we have found to an alarming extent the infiltration of gangsters and hoodlums into certain unions. And they have gone into the Teamsters Union because historically the Teamsters Union has been the most powerful institution. And at the present time, they are the most powerful institution in the United States, with the exception of the federal government, because they control all transportation. And that is not just trucking transportation. They control all transportation. Because when the trains bring the goods into San Francisco, it's the truckers which make the decision as to whether they're going to be pickups or deliveries. The same thing as far as the docks are concerned, the same thing as far as the airports are concerned. And because it's got such great power, it is also a vehicle of extortion. And I'd like to give you some examples of the kind of people who run the Central Conference of Teamsters. We made an investigation of Mr. Herman Kierdorf. Mr. Herman Kierdorf went to the penitentiary in 1933 for impersonating a federal officer. He got out in 1935. He was made a Teamster Union official. He went back into the penitentiary in 1942 for armed robbery, this time in Ohio. Mr. Hoffa wrote the warden a letter in 1949 asking that Mr. Kierdorf be released and made a Teamster Union official. He got out. He was made a Teamster Union official. We found him in 1957 going around placing picket lines in front of businesses, not to try to organize them, but to get them to bring their work to a company that was run by a friend of his, Mr. Angelo Mealy, who was formerly public enemy number one in the city of Detroit and used to tour the city of Detroit with machine gun emplacements on the top of his Cadillac. Mr. Herman Kierdorf's nephew, Mr. Frank Kierdorf, came out of the penitentiary in Michigan for armed robbery in 1952. He was made a Teamster Union official in Flint, Michigan, head of Local 332. He was a Teamster Union official until he was burned to death several months ago while setting a cleaning establishment on fire. But that local is still in good hands. It's run by Mr. Jack Thompson, who's been arrested 15 times and convicted on five occasions, including armed robbery and arson. We go down into Chicago. Mr. Joey Glimko. Now, I'll give you one more example in Detroit. Mr. Ziggy Snyder was sentenced 20 to 40 years for armed robbery. He came out. He was placed in charge of the docks by Mr. Hoffa as a Teamster Union official. He enjoyed working on the docks, so he formed a company to load and unload ships. But Ziggy Snyder, a union official, forgot to organize Ziggy Snyder Businessman. So Ziggy Snyder Businessman operated non-union. He then enjoyed being a businessman so much that he formed a car wash business, and he operated that non-union also. We found another Teamster official who had been convicted of sodomy, who was going around placing picket lines in front of companies to get them to bring their work to Ziggy Snyder's non-union car wash. In Chicago, Illinois, Joey Glimko has been arrested 36 times, twice for murder. He's Mr. Hoffa's chief lieutenant. He was indicted for an extortion in 1955. He took $124,000 of union funds to defend himself in that extortion charge, having nothing to do at all with union affairs. Mr. Gus Sapp stated he'd been arrested so many times in Illinois, he went to Indiana. He was made a Teamster Union official of the Indiana Conference of Teamsters. In Tennessee, Mr. Glenn Smith. Mr. Glenn Smith was convicted of robbery. He was convicted of burglary. In 1952, he was indicted on 10 counts. After he was indicted, he took $20,000 to fix the judge. The judge was fixed. Mr. Glenn Smith said he shouldn't use his union position because it didn't violate the Teamster Constitution to corrupt a public official. Mr. Hoffa evidently agreed with him, because when he was indicted on income tax evasion, the attorneys who were paid out of union funds came in and argued before the court that Glenn Smith shouldn't have to pay taxes on this money because, number one, he kept it for such a short time when he was giving it to the judge, he shouldn't have to pay taxes on it. And if the court wouldn't believe that, that means that Glenn Smith had embezzled the money. And embezzled funds do not constitute income, so therefore he shouldn't have to pay taxes on it. Mr. W.A. Smith in Nashville, Tennessee, no relation to Glenn Smith, has been arrested 17 times and convicted on 13 occasions. Mr. Ray Cohen in Philadelphia is the head of the biggest local in that city. He has 18 organizers working for him, all of them police records. I'll just give you one example in New York City. Sam Goldstein was convicted twice before he became a Teamster Union official. After he became a Teamster Union official, he was convicted twice of extortion. In 1958, Mr. Hoffa filed a statement with the committee saying that Mr. Sam Goldstein was no longer a Teamster Union official. We made an investigation in 1959. We found that Sam Goldstein was in the penitentiary for extortion. He was still president of his local, 239. He was receiving $375 a week salary and $25 a week expenses while in jail. It is a very serious situation because these people own and control the Teamsters Union. They own and control Mr. Hoffa. And you're not going to get rid of the corruption or dishonesty or gangsterism in the Teamsters Union as long as you have Mr. Hoffa as the international president. He cannot get rid of these people. They own him and they own the Teamsters Union. And it's going to spread here to the West Coast. You mark my words, it has started already. And this is not a situation that management can point to the House of Labor and say there the fault is. Because this is just as much the fault of management. These things would not have been possible if it hadn't been for the help and assistance of some of the biggest companies and corporations in the United States. And I talk about Mr. Dave Beck. His rise to power financially would not have been possible if it hadn't been for companies such as the Anheuser-Busch Company, the Fruithof Trailer Company, the Associated Transport Company. And I speak about some of the other big companies in the United States who have made sweetheart deals with the labor union officials, the AMP Company, the Food Fair Company. Or you have the cartage companies in New York City who hired James Squilanti, the self-styled godson of Albert Anastasia, to handle their labor management affairs. Or the biggest restaurants in the city of Chicago for the past 21 years have hired the biggest gangsters and hoodlums to handle their labor management affairs. Not to try to avoid unionization by legitimate means, but to try to bribe employees, to blackmail employees, so that they could save a few extra cents each week. And we have the situation of the Nathan W. Schefferman operation, where we have companies such as Sears Roebuck Company, the Whirlpool Company, the Morton Frozen Food Company, which used his service to try to pass on money to union officials, to bribe employees, to try to avoid unionization. So this and the Risk Trucking Company, the Commercial Carriers Company, which set Jimmy Hoffa up in a trucking company his wife's maiden name when he came in and settled a strike for them. And I say that this is not a situation where attorneys can point to management or labor and say they're the fault is, because many of these deals have been set up by attorneys. And we have found that at least 18 different occasions that attorneys have acted improperly. We have found at least 50 different companies and corporations in the United States that have acted improperly. And yet the only group that has taken any action, except for the state of Tennessee, which took some action in the Bar Association, the only group that's taken any action to deal with corruption within their midst has been the AFL-CIO. I know no management group that's taken any action to deal with these situations, and I know of no bar association except the state of Tennessee. This is a problem for all of us as Americans. Not one of us can point to any other group and say there the fault is. You might not have these situations here in the West Coast as we do in the Midwest and in the East, but this is coming in your direction. And unless we all start to take an interest in how these things are being run and how our government is being run, unless we take a strong position when these deals are offered to us to turn them down, even though it might be an economic advantage momentarily, we are all going to be in great difficulty. I say that Congress saw fit to meet their responsibility of passing some legislation to deal with these problems, as Mr. Lynch here, the district attorney, saw fit to meet his responsibility. If we could have more people such as him throughout the United States, we wouldn't have problems. But you people also have a responsibility and obligation to me to turn these deals down when they are offered and to take an interest in how your local government is being run, how your schools are being run, how your state is being run, and how the federal government is being run. If you meet your responsibility, as Congress has met their responsibility, I think we can look back upon this era as a real step forward for American society and something which will make this country even a better place in which to live. Thank you very much.
Question and answer period will be conducted by Mr. Lloyd Grabeel, Vice President of the Commonwealth Club of California. Mr. Grabeel.
If you return, Mr. Kennedy, to the lectern, I think you can tell by the applause that followed your remarks today, remarks is an inadequate term, that this large and enthusiastic delegation of members here at the Commonwealth at this Friday luncheon today appreciate the challenge of the job you've been doing and of the message you have brought to them. And now, as might be anticipated, the questions are searching and on several sides of the question. And the first question I would like you to read with me and then answer is, how is it that Hoffa is not in jail instead of being president of the union?
Many of the situations that I discussed with you today were not covered by law in the past. And that was why we all felt that it was so essential that we have some legislation. If he did some of the same things that in the future that he has done in the past, he undoubtedly would be indicted for some offense, and then, of course, a jury would make a decision as to whether he should be sent to jail. There is are grand juries that are looking into his affairs in various sections of the United States, as has been announced already. I don't think that the fight is over as far as Mr. Hoffa is concerned.
Mr. Kennedy, two or three questions go to the content or the lack of content of the law. One, should not union officers with criminal records going back more than 5 years be debarred from holding office?
Yeah, that is covered in the bill. That was one of the areas that was covered in the bill, that if an individual has been convicted of a major crime for the period of the past 5 years or has been in the penitentiary for the period of the past 5 years, he cannot hold union office. The same thing as far as management is concerned. You can't have an individual who's been convicted of a crime handling your labor management affairs if he's been in jail for the period of the past 5 years or if he's been convicted of a crime for the period of the past 5 years.
Now, apparently, this informed member of Commonwealth was aware of the five-year provision. He thinks it should be more than that. He wants to know whether back more than 5 years.
Well, I think that's a question of opinion. 5 years seems adequate to me.
Has not the new law gone far beyond the racketeering issue?
In several provisions, it did go beyond the racketeering. And I think that in some areas, it was extremely unfair. I think particularly in the field of organizational picketing, I think that it was improved somewhat after it came out of the House of Representatives. But it's going to make in organizational work in the South almost impossible. The Textile Workers Union now spends about $1 million every year. And since the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act, have hardly picked up a new member. This is going to virtually put them out of business. And you've got people that are working down there for 65 or 70 cents an hour that should be organized. And without the weapon of organizational picketing, it's going to make it virtually impossible. And I think that's extremely unfair. And I think that it's going to have another effect on industry in the North. It's going to send a great deal of that industry down to the South, where wages are going to be deflated continuously.
You have answered the next question that I had in my hand precisely on that point. Did the committee investigate any of the rackets carried on by business?
I believe that I went into that to some extent. We did go into the affairs. I don't think there was a major case that we went into where there was not some racketeering or dishonesty on the part of management. And for the most part, these were large companies and corporations in the United States. I think it is, as I said it earlier, I think it is a very serious situation, and it's not something that management can say the fault is with labor, because this is a fault and a problem for all of us.
Several questions, Mr. Kennedy, go to the adequacy or inadequacy of the measure. Do you think that the recently passed labor bill has sufficient teeth to control labor racketeers?
I do. I think it's a major step forward. As I say, I don't agree with the bill in all respects. But it deals with the control over union funds. It deals with democratic procedures and processes. It deals with trusteeships. It deals with the no man's land. It deals with the employer coming in and setting up a middleman to try to avoid unionization by improper means. It controls, it makes employers report how their money is being used when they're trying to avoid unionization. I think these are all major steps forward. And something that was all of these things were suggested by our committee. As I say, I don't think the legislation is perfect, but no legislation that is passed by Congress is perfect.
Since you have indicated your belief that the measure may prevent effective organization in the South, and to that extent is unfair to organized labor, what provisions other than that of the new law do you consider unfair to organized labor?
I think it's basically regarding organizational picketing and to some extent the secondary boycott, although in the conference between the Senate and the House, that was remarkably improved. I think that there's still problems on that which will make it very difficult to organize. This is not going to be a problem for the large unions, these two provisions of secondary boycott and organizational picketing. The only thing that it really will affect will be the smaller unions, and where it will really affect them is in the unorganized South. It's not going to really have much effect other than there, but it's going to make that their work that much more difficult.
We have a couple of questions indicating some relationship there with the Taft-Hartley Act. Should controls on corrupt unions and management be created through a revision of the Taft-Hartley in view of reticence to negotiate by unions and MANA in steel? And what changes are indicated in Taft-Hartley to avoid present unsatisfactory situations with respect to the steel strike and like conditions?
Well, now, that is outside of my area because I have dealt with corruption and gangsterism and dishonesty, and this is a labor management dispute. I have my own personal views on it, but I couldn't give you any informed opinion on it, so I'd rather leave that to someone else.
If you feel that the West Coast Teamsters Union has a good background, what comments would you care to make in comparing this union with the West Coast Longshore and Warehouse Union?
Well, from what I understand, the West Coast longshoremen are a good deal to the left of the Teamsters Union. Beyond that, we did not go into any corruption or dishonesty, with one exception in the West Coast Longshoremen's Union, and that was in connection with an attempt by Mr. Hoffa and certain high officials of the longshoremen here on the West Coast to interfere with the monitors, which had been appointed by court over the control of the Teamsters Union. Beyond that, we did not go into corruption or dishonesty. We didn't have a great number of complaints about corruption or dishonesty within the Longshoremen's Union. There have been complaints, of course, that it is dominated and controlled at the top by left-wing or communist operators. But beyond that, we didn't have evidence or information that came to our attention in connection with dishonesty or corruption within the union, with that one exception.
Now, the inevitable question you might expect along the line of Mr. Ruther. Two questions, then I'll read the third. Why didn't you set Walter Ruther, or Get, I guess the word is, before the committee? This gentleman prints worse than I do. That's bad. And with approximately 3 years of hearings before the McClellan Committee, why was so little time devoted to Ruther and his UAW union? Now I will give you the third question, and I'd like, because you may want to spend a little time. Would you please explain why you stated on the 21st of October in Los Angeles that the GOP members of the Senate Rackets Committee have, quotes, gave Walter Ruther a clean bill of health after a full investigation? In reply to your statement, as quoted, Senator Barry Goldwater stated just yesterday that their findings were directly opposite.
Well, this whole problem or situation in connection with Walter Ruther has been a very difficult one. Starting back in April and May of 1957, there were stories that appeared in the newspapers that because of the fact that I am a Democrat and because my brother was serving on the committee and was being mentioned at that time as a presidential candidate, and because of the fact that Walter Ruther had always supported the Democrats and was probably the union official who was closer to the Democrats than any other union official, that we were whitewashing Walter Ruther and that we would not dare go into an investigation of Walter Ruther. At that time, in May or June of 1957, I went to the chairman of the committee and said that I felt that no matter what we came up with in connection with an investigation of Walter Ruther, it would not fully satisfy certain members of the committee and possibly certain parts of the press of the United States, and that the thing of the greatest importance was that the public have confidence in the work of the committee. There had been an investigator that had been appointed to our committee by the name of Jack McGovern, who had been appointed by the Republicans. So I requested at that time that Mr. McGovern be put in charge of the investigation of Walter Ruther and be put in charge of the investigation of the UAW. The chairman took this up with the members of the committee in a meeting that we held in June of 1957, and that was agreed to. He was placed in full charge of the whole investigation of Walter Reuther. We held hearings. This first question says, why didn't you get Walter Reuther before the committee? We held, Mr. McGovern held and conducted an investigation for some 7 months. We then held 5 weeks of hearings on the UAW in connection with the UAW COLA dispute and in connection with Walter Reuther. Every witness, now you consider that it's on this committee, is Senator Goldwater, Senator Munt, and Senator Curtis. Every witness that anybody wanted, any member of the committee wanted, was called before that committee. They decided the order of the witnesses before the committee. And every matter that they wanted to gone into first was investigated by Mr. McGovern and then was gone into before the committee. There is nothing beyond that that we could do. Now, the problem is, as far as Walter Reuther and the UAW is concerned, is Walter Reuther happens to be an honest man, and the UAW happens to be an honest union. And there's nothing that you're going to do to change that. You might not like Walter Reuther. You might not like to go around the world with him on a tandem bike. You might not like his financial policies or what he thinks. But that is not going to make him corrupt. He's got his books and records for 17 years. Every cent that he spent, he's got for 17 years. He goes into a hotel. He stays at the least expensive hotel room. He pays for his shine. He pays for his haircut. He's got his books and records for 17 years. Mr. Hoffa, people say, well, why don't you do to Mr. Reuther what you did to Mr. Hoffa? Mr. Hoffa has written one check in his life. He's got one check. He deals solely in cash. Furthermore, at the end of the investigation, at the request of the committee, the same investigator who conducted the investigation of Mr. Dave Beck and Mr. Jimmy Hoffa, the man by the name of Carmine Bellino, who I don't know whether he's a Republican or a Democrat. I don't know what any of our staff is except Jack McGovern, who's a Republican, because we never asked. But he went in and conducted the same kind of investigation of the UAW's books and the same kind of investigation of Walter Reuther as he had conducted of Dave Beck and Jimmy Hoffa. And it's just not corrupt. The UAW's books are the best books that we ever reviewed without any exception, whether it be company, management, or labor. Now, I'm not saying that there is not corruption within the UAW. There's 800,000 or 900,000 members, and there is bound to be some corruption. But it is not deep-seated corruption, such as the Teamsters Union, and it is an honestly run union. They try to avoid corruption, and when they find corruption within their midst, they take steps against it. Now, we have been into many Democrats. We have been into unions that have supported Democrats. The first investigation that we conducted, it was in connection with Multnomah County, which is the district attorney who was a Democrat. And one of the most, the mayor of the city, we had him before the committee. He was one of the most popular vote-getters in the state of Oregon. We went into Lake County, Holovachka, who was the district attorney there, one of the major political figures in the state of Indiana, a judge in Tennessee who was a Democrat. We have gone into Republicans and Democrats alike. I never gave a damn. But I'm not going to have the committee used for political purposes if I can help it. If anybody had any information over 2.5 years that Walter Reuther was corrupt or the UAW was corrupt, that would have been presented to the committee because the Republicans would have demanded it be presented to the committee. But it is just not so, and just hoping that it's going to be so, hoping that Walter Reuther is dishonest or the UAW is dishonest, is not going to make it so. And the sooner that big business and management realizes that, the better off we all will be.
And now, Mr. Kennedy, very briefly, because you can either answer this question in 2 hours or in 30 seconds, evaluate your brother's chances of capturing the Democratic nomination for president.
Well, the only thing is, I think, that the country is about ready for the smartest, brightest, quickest, most skillful man in the country. And it's not me.
The meeting is adjourned. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy.